Singer and songwriter Ray Bolts has won 2 Gospel Music Association Dove Awards, the Christian equivalent of Grammys. He was, back in the 1990s, one of the leading contemporary Christian recording artists. A little over 10 years ago, he began worshiping here on occasion, though I had no idea who he was. He was just a new guy that we were getting acquainted with. After church one Sunday, he greeted me and handed me a CD, said, "Here, I want you to have this. I've really been enjoying worshiping here, and this is a token of my appreciation." I thanked him politely, while in the back of my mind thinking, does everybody have a CD these days? He probably cut it in his basement, right? But later that week, I popped it into the CD player in my vehicle and listened, and I thought, ooh, this is pretty good. It was a Christmas album. So when I saw him at church next, I said, "Thank you for that CD you gave me. You know, you're really good. Have you ever thought about doing this full-time professionally?" He very politely said something like, "Oh, well, yeah, that is kind of what I do." Clueless, I said, "Good for you." Later that week in the church office, I was talking to our then worship minister, Julie Walsh. I said to her, "You know, there's a new guy who's been at church occasionally who says he's a professional musician. He was here on Sunday. Have you ever heard the name Ray Bolts?" She gets this stunned look on her face, slaps the table in front of her and says, "Oh my God, Ray Bolts was here on Sunday?" I said, "Yeah." She starts flipping through her file. "What did we sing on Sunday? I hope it was presentable." I said, "Who is this guy?" She says, "You don't know?" I said, "No." She said, "He's only one of the greatest Christian recording artists of the prior decade." Oh. So I went to my computer, crafted an email. "Dear Ray, you must think I'm an idiot. Won't be the first, won't be the last." But I honestly didn't have a clue. He sent back a very gracious note saying, "Don't give it a second thought. I'm just grateful that I have a wonderful place to worship when I'm passing through Indiana." A few months later, he did a concert for us. Phenomenal. Yes. And in that process, I learned something really important about him. He's a genuinely kind, humble person. It's fascinating to get to know people, isn't it? Especially when they're famous. We want to know, for better or worse, what are they like? What makes them tick? We're in the midst of a new sermon series about Jesus, the most famous person to ever live. Amen. The goal of this sermon series is to get to know him better, to be able to experience him personally at a deeper level. Most of us, of course, know the basic biographical facts about Jesus, but in this series, I'm inviting us to take it deeper and to ask ourselves not just who was Jesus, but what is he like in terms of personality and character traits? Because Jesus once said, John 14:9, "Whoever has seen me has seen the Father." In other words, the deeper I understand who Jesus is and what makes him tick, the deeper I will understand who God is and what it's like to be in relationship with the Supreme Being. So, with all that in mind, today I want to invite us to ask a very specific question about Jesus. What was his perspective on life reduced to its core? As he lived from day to day and encountered everyday life experiences, ups and downs, what was the primary lens through which he interpreted and responded to life's events? Because as followers of Jesus, we might want to consider adopting the same perspective. Let's start with a prayer. Jesus, Reveal yourself more fully to us today. We want to know you better. As you confronted the ups and downs of everyday life, what kept you going? What gave you strength? Deepen our understanding, we pray, in your holy name. Amen. So, if you could only pick one story to best illustrate the essence of Jesus' approach to life, which story would you choose? There are many to choose from, of course, and it's a difficult choice to make, but somewhere near the top of my list would be today's gospel reading, Mark chapter 9. As we join the story, Jesus has been up on a mountain praying. As he comes back down, a crowd, huge crowd, has gathered around his followers, around his disciples, and there's quite a commotion. Jesus asks, "What's going on?" Mark chapter 9, verse 17, someone from the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son. He has a spirit that makes him unable to speak. And whenever it seizes him, it dashes him down and he foams and he grinds his teeth and he becomes rigid. And I asked your disciples to cast it out, but they could not do so." So you get the picture, right? You who are parents, remember what it felt like the first time you held your newborn child. Priceless, precious, beyond words. The father in today's story had once felt that when he first held his newborn son. Precious, priceless. And as his son continued to grow over time, the intensity of the love he felt for his son grew ever greater, an unbreakable, infinite bond between them. But then imagine that day, that terrible day when something went terribly wrong. I picture them around their home somewhere, dad sitting there and his son over out of his peripheral vision is down on the floor, and dad assumes he's just playing, he's just having fun. But then when dad casts his glance over that direction, he sees something that sends a shockwave, a chill through his soul. His son is twitching and then convulses, goes into a full-blown seizure. Can you imagine what that dad felt in that moment? Oh my God, what's happening to my son? And I'm sure after that he asked every parent he could talk to, "Have you ever seen anything like this? Do you know anything I can do?" I'm sure he went from healer to doctor to healer, looking for someone who could give them answers. As his son continued to decline, then somebody in his village tells him about a healer that they've heard about named Jesus. Maybe he can help. When you love somebody, you're desperate. You'll do whatever it takes. And so this man brings his son from afar to where Jesus is, except Jesus is up on the mountain, unavailable. And so Jesus' disciples say, "Oh, we'll pray for him." They lay hands on him and pray for him. Nothing. Nothing at all. His heart sinks. His last hope. Cruel world. I want us to try to imagine what the father in this story was experiencing so that we can feel the full impact of what's happening and what Jesus was confronting. Let me share with you an excerpt from an actual letter that a father wrote to his critically ill daughter in a book called When God Doesn't Make Sense. This father wrote, "My dear Bristol, before you were born, I prayed for you. In my heart, I knew you would be a little angel, and so you were. When you were born on my birthday, April the 7th, it was evident that you were an extra special gift from the Lord. How profound a gift you turned out to be. More than gurgles and rosy cheeks, more than the firstborn of my flesh, your joy unspeakable. You showed me God's love more than anything else in all creation. Bristol, you taught me how to love. I loved you when you were cuddly and cute, and when you jabbered your first words. I loved you when the searing realization began to take hold that something was wrong, and that maybe you weren't developing as quickly as your peers. I loved you even when we understood it was more serious than that. I loved you when we went from hospital to clinic to doctor, looking for a medical diagnosis that would bring us some hope. And of course, we prayed. We always prayed for you and prayed. I loved you when you moaned and cried. Your mom, your sisters, and I would drive for hours late at night to help you fall asleep. I loved you when you were confused, when with tears in your eyes, you would bite your fingers or your lip by accident. I loved you when your eyes crossed, then when you went blind. I loved you when you could no longer speak, and the only thing I longed to hear was, "Daddy, I love you." My dear Bristol, now you are free. I look forward to the day when, according to God's promises, we will be back together, completely whole, full of joy. Before you were born, I prayed for you. In my heart, I knew you would be a little angel. And so you were. Love, Daddy. I share that with you because I want us to feel at a gut level what the Father in this gospel story was experiencing, what was at stake in his life. This was life on the edge, which is exactly where we have to begin if we really want to understand Jesus, because we learn the most about a person when they're in a situation that is desperate, that pushes them to the edge, how they interpret that situation, how they respond to it. Notice how Jesus responds to this situation. Mark 19:25, when Jesus saw that the crowd was running together, afraid, what's happening to this boy? Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit, saying, "You spirit that keeps this boy from speaking and hearing, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." Notice how Jesus is conceptualizing this situation. Notice how personal he makes it. He speaks personally to a spirit, an evil spirit that is afflicting this boy. That doesn't mean that this boy wasn't ill. From the way the symptoms are described, we get the impression that this boy had what we today would call epilepsy, an actual physical malady with actual physical causes. But at a higher level, philosophically, where does illness come from? Why does illness exist? Is it because it's God's will? No. It's because of the brokenness of the world that we find ourselves in. Just one of many manifestations of the brokenness, of the evil that surrounds us in the world around us. Illness is just one manifestation, like poverty, anger, broken relationships, hatred, addiction, violence, prejudice. We live in a world that is full of evil, awash in evil. Jesus put it this way, John 16:33, "In this world you will have tribulation." No ifs, ands, or buts about it. In this world, Jesus says, mark it down, whoever you are, wherever you are, whatever your life turns out at, in this world you will have tribulation. And for Jesus, this tribulation we experience, it's personal. For example, in Luke 22:31, Jesus to his disciple Simon Peter says to him once, "Simon, Simon, Satan has desired to have you that he may sift you like wheat." Let that picture sink into your head. In Jesus' mind, Satan has targeted Simon Peter and said, "I'm going to take you apart limb by limb." That's an image. That's an understanding of evil that is personal. This idea of Satan, the devil, evil spirits, and demons strategically, actively going after us. Some Christians, like myself, take these words of Jesus literally. Satan, demons, actual level of beings, fallen angels that somehow intersect with our reality in ways that aren't quite clear to us. Other Christians take these words of Jesus as being metaphorical, as creating a model for us to think about how evil in the abstract operates in this world. Whichever way you happen to see it, I think we can probably all agree on the core truth behind what Jesus is saying here, namely that the way we experience evil in the world, it's as if it is active, strategic, and intelligent. Picture Vladimir Putin and some of his minions sitting in a computer lab in Moscow, trying to hack into computers and create chaos in cultures all across the globe. That's kind of the image that we get from Jesus of how evil operates in this world. It's active, it's strategic. It reminds me of those famous words from the Martin Luther hymn where he says, "And though this world with devils filled should threaten to undo us." What a powerful word image. A world full of devils trying to undo us. I know someone right now who in recent months has lost a beloved parent. And during that same time frame has also lost a beloved stepchild to suicide, shot himself in front of his infant kids. And during that same time period, her daughter, her adult daughter, comes home, moves back home with her two infants after being beaten by her husband for multiple times, but is still thinking about going back. This person I'm talking about, how do you think it's going for her? She's hanging by her fingernails. Don't tell me we're not under attack. Life is going to try to take you apart piece by piece. A world filled with devils seeking to undo us. Christian author Brené Brown puts it this way. She recently said, I definitely went back to church for all the wrong reasons. She says, I went back because life is hard and hurts, and all the midlife unraveling books say, go back to church. That's what everybody does. So I went back to church thinking it would be like an epidural, like it would take away all the pain. But then I discovered that faith in church was not like an epidural at all. It was more like a midwife who just stood next to me and said, push, it's supposed to hurt. If you are hoping for an escape from your hardships in life, if that's what brings you here and causes you to seek Jesus, you're in the wrong place. In this world, you will have tribulation. A couple years ago, when her family moved out to Colorado and bought a new home, 4-year-old Sydney Farrenbrook decided that her family's new home needed to pass one more inspection, an inspection for monsters. So she did what any thoughtful 4-year-old worried about monsters would do. The next time she encountered a local police officer, she asked if he would come and inspect her house for monsters. He said yes. So when he shows up, he and Sydney look everywhere. They look in closets. They look under beds. They look under the couch. They look under the cushions. They even go out in the yard to look for telltale traces of monster activity. Then the police officer confidently pronounces that Sydney's home is monster-free. Sydney's mom says, you have no idea how much confidence that has given her. Now she wants to grow up and be a cop and help other people find monsters. With the innocence of a child, we come to Jesus hoping he will tell us there are no monsters. Instead, he says, I'm sorry, but I've got to tell you the truth. I'm not going to sell you a bill of goods. I'm not going to sell you some pie-in-the-sky religiosity. I've got to tell you, there are monsters in this world. We find ourselves in the midst of a world full of devils who threaten to undo us. So what are we supposed to do with that? Picture Jesus when he was a little boy, and his mom would tell him stories. I assume Jesus, like other kids, would bargain with mom, "Mom, before I go to sleep, please tell me a story." "Okay," Mary would say, "what story do you want to hear?" Most kids get stuck on certain stories, right? Their favorite stories. I'll bet one of Jesus' favorite stories that Mary told him when he was a child were the stories of his birth. "Mom, tell me a story tonight." "All right, what will it be tonight?" "Tell me the story of my birth." "Jesus, I just told you that again last night. Tell it to me again, Mom." "Okay." It goes like this. "It was a dark night, and an angel appeared to me and told me that you were going to be born, a miracle child. And I said, 'How can this be?' And the angel said," at this point Jesus chimes in because he's heard it so many times, you know, like kids do when they get to their favorite line. "And the angel said, 'Nothing will be impossible with God.'" Luke 1:37. "Nothing will be impossible." That simple phrase in that powerful story that Mary no doubt told Jesus multiple times when he was a little boy must have sunk deep into his subconscious, because in his public ministry we see that phrase recurring, echoing again and again and again through the teachings of Jesus. For example, once in Matthew 19:26, Jesus said to his disciples, "For mortals it is impossible, but for God all things are possible." On a different occasion, in Luke chapter 18, verse 27, Jesus said, what is impossible for mortals is possible for God. Same echo of that same phrase. In today's gospel lesson, Mark chapter 9, did you catch what Jesus said in response to the Father when the Father is ready to give up all hope and says, "If you can help us, if you can do anything for us, please have pity on us"? And Jesus responds, Mark 9:23, "If you're able, all things can be done for the one who believes." And that brings us, it seems to me, to the core of how Jesus saw life, the core of how Jesus, from day to day, approached every circumstance he encountered. All things can be done for the one who believes. Now, I don't want to be overly lawyerly here, but I notice the precise way this phrase is worded here. Note that it does not say all things will be done for the one who believes. It says all things can be done. If you ask me, "Jeff, do you think such and such will happen?" And I say, "It will." That's a promise. That's certitude. But if you say to me, "Jeff, do you think so and so will happen?" And I say, "It can." That's the language of possibility. That means it's possible, so it's worth a try. Let's see what happens. Let's see what we can do. Jesus calls us, like him, as his followers, to approach every situation we face in life with that core perspective. All things can be done for the one who believes. And so as a believer, even in dire circumstances, I say to myself, nothing is impossible with God. And so I am ruling nothing out in this situation. My child might be supernaturally healed or not. If my child is not supernaturally healed, then I believe that he and I will receive supernatural help to get through it until we're together again in glory, so that whatever happens, no matter what evil can throw at me, ultimately, in the end, it cannot, it will not break me. And so in any situation I face, I will approach it with an attitude that says, I'm going to ask for and seek what I hope for, because with God, all things are possible. And if that doesn't happen, then I'm going to ask for and seek my next best hope. And if that doesn't happen, then I'm going to ask for and seek my next best hope. So on and so forth, never giving up hope, because with God, anything. possible. It's what some people call possibility thinking. It's, by the way, exactly how Jesus thought about his death. John chapter 2, verse 19, John said to his opponents, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up again." By temple, Jesus meant his body. And so what he's saying here to his opponents is, you may be able to kill me, but even if you kill me, God will raise me right back up again. Because nothing is impossible with God. It's never too late with God. All things can be done for the one who believes. One afternoon, a woman was walking along a beautiful sandy beach when she noticed a porcelain teapot-shaped lamp peeking out of the sand. She picked it up, brushed the sand off, and poof, a genie appears. The woman says, "Does this mean I get 3 wishes? "No," the genie says, "you caught me in a bad mood. You get 1 wish, make it good." All right. She thinks for a moment, and then she begins to patiently draw in the sand. She draws a map of the Middle East. She says to the genie, "You see this map here? I want you to bring peace to the Middle East. That's my wish." The genie says, "Gadzooks, lady, I'm good, but I'm not that good. These nations have been at war for thousands of years. Ask for something else." "Okay," she says. Thanks for a bit. "Oh, I've got it," she says. "Here's my wish. Genie, I want you to fix my husband. I want you to take away all those annoying things that he does. No more belching, no more farting, no more leaving the toilet seat up, no more switching the channel off of what I want to watch. I want him to enjoy what I enjoy, to be infinitely patient, kind, and generous. Genie, I want you to fix my husband." The genie sighs deeply, then says to her, "Let me see that map again." Life is full of impossible situations. When we encounter those impossible situations, we have a choice. One option is to yield to despair. The other option is to engage in a little possibility thinking. Nothing will be impossible with God. The current issue of Time magazine is all about what they call the art of optimism. The lead article in a series of articles about optimism is written by Guillermo del Toro. And here is some of what Guillermo says. "These days," he writes, "the safest way to appear intelligent is to be skeptical by default. We seem sophisticated when we say we don't believe, and disingenuous when we say we do. But," he says, "I believe optimism is radical. It's the hard choice, the brave choice. Every day we become the balance of our choices, choices between love and fear, belief or despair. No hope is ever too small. Optimism is not uncool. It's rebellious and daring and vital." This is the life that Jesus calls us to. The rebellious, daring life of someone who says, all things are possible for the one who believes. Nothing was ever accomplished by despair. Extraordinary things are accomplished by people who dare to believe. Let me close with this. In the same current issue of Time magazine, in one of the other articles about optimism, is written by Laverne Cox. Laverne Cox is the first transgender person to ever be nominated for an Emmy Award. She has accomplished something that people thought was impossible. So Time magazine asked her to write about her experience. What is it that gave her the audacious belief that she could accomplish her dreams, her goals in life? Because she comes from an African-American background, she explains in her article that she often looks to her African-American past for inspiration in her life. And so in her article, she tells us, reminds us of the story of Marianne Williamson, an African-American operatic singer who in the 1930s toured Europe and created a huge sensation singing in opera houses across Europe. Marianne Williamson was once told by Arturo Toscanini, the Italian conductor, "A voice like yours is heard once every 100 years." She became a superstar opera singer, but then came back to the United States where she found that she was still banned from many concert halls because of her African-American heritage, and she was banned from many restaurants and hotels in the cities that she would travel to sing in. Then in 1939, her manager tried to book her for a performance in Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C., only to discover that Constitution Hall is operated by the Daughters of the American Revolution, who as of 1939 still banned African Americans from performing in Constitution Hall. When Eleanor Roosevelt heard about this, she was not amused. So Eleanor Roosevelt arranged for Marianne Anderson to sing at the Lincoln Memorial. The crowd that turned out that day is estimated at 75,000 people. Constitution Hall couldn't hold a fraction of that. Now she's singing on the National Mall to 75,000 people. As Laverne Cox writes, "There's something radical about a black woman singing classical music at the Lincoln Memorial to 75,000 people. Nothing will be impossible with God." It's stories like that that gave Laverne Cox the courage to believe that she could become. But she doesn't stop there. She goes on to tell about a 9-year-old girl named Lee Linton Price who hears Marianne Anderson sing and turns to her mom and says, "That's what I'm going to do. That's what I'm going to become." You see, Linton Price is also African American. "Mommy, that's who I'm going to be. If she can do it, I can do it." Fast forward to 1961 when Linton Price debuts at the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. She performs in such a way, she is so dazzling, they give her a 42-minute standing ovation, one of the longest ovations in the history of the Met. Can you imagine a 42-minute standing ovation? Fast forward another 20 years to the early 1980s, and the Daughters of the American Revolution reach out to Linton Price and say, "We'd like to ask you to sing at Constitution Hall." Imagine the drama of that moment as Linton steps out onto the stage, pauses, and dedicates her performance to Marianne Anderson. Laverne Cox says, "I watch that video often, and when I do, it always gives me goosebumps." If Marianne Anderson can, then that means Linton Price can. And if Linton Price can, that means that Laverne Cox can. And if Laverne Cox can, that means that you can. Nothing will be impossible with God. This is not some rational statement that's meant to be demonstrated by a data-driven scientific formula. This is a defiant proclamation of faith, an attitude toward life that Jesus calls us to take. Nothing will be impossible with God. It's a broken hallelujah. It's a statement that says, you may keep me out of Constitution Hall. I may never be able to sing there, but it will happen someday. Somebody who's like me will do it. You may be able to kick me down, but you cannot keep me down. You may even be able to kill me, but God will raise me back up again. Because all things can be done for the one who believes. So there's good news and there's bad news today. The bad news is, if you came here looking for an escape from the hardships of life, you're in the wrong place. The good news is, if you came here looking for a way to triumph over and power through the hardships of life, you're in the right place. Because all things can be done for those who believe. Do you dare to live as though you believe, and you will discover the power of Christ in you? Dare to believe, and you will experience Jesus at a deeper level than you ever have before. Christ in you, Christ in me. I can do all things. All things. Whatever life throws at me, I can do it.